It's a great pleasure to be here. I was thrilled to be asked by the HSTM and the planning committee to be the captive customer in the room. I'd like to start by saying just a few words about Chicago, because we definitely fall on one end of the spectrum, and I want to make it clear that I don't necessarily represent all libraries. I represent one, a rather small niche. We're big, we're private, we are comprehensive and exhaustive, we are intensely academic, and we have an amazing cadre of researchers in my institution who work very heavily in the library using both print and electronic collections. And indeed, this is true through the sciences, STM, the professional schools, but in particular, my humanists and my social sciences tell a very convincing story that the library is their laboratory. And for those reasons, we actually still have people coming in the door, and indeed, we are building more stack space on campus. Unheard of probably for most places. This is the Mansueto Library. It is going to house 3.5 million volumes on campus, connected to the main library, and have a glorious glass-domed reading room on top. We believe this will be filled in about 20 years. We continue to add about 180,000 print volumes every year, and that number has not changed in decades. We are buying just as much print as we ever did, but we're buying other stuff too. I also find that we're worrying about very different things than we were a few years ago. Michael talked about technology. We are at a point where we are about to invest heavily to transform our technology. It's going to be open source, community-based, SOA. It's going to be part of our campus-wide enterprise, not a standalone operation. I hope that I can have conversations with you as publishers in terms of how you can also enter into this new technological space with us, because I believe it will be transformational. We're also worrying about things that will seem odd to you, like branding. The bottom of my first screen here has our brand new library logo that we actually spent money on. And we had consultants, and we had every little thing means something. It's meant to send a message. Libraries aren't used to thinking in that way. We're communicating, and we're also in the digital world. We just moved to 100% digital dissertations, so we're facing those same hurdles and learning curves that the publishers are. Real quickly, I want to talk about how we're spending our budget. All ebooks are not created equal. I think we all know that. Some examples of how this is changing my print usage or not changing my print usage in some cases. The role of the readers and the delivery platforms, discoverability and partnerships, and finally, a new emphasis on return on investment. My budget. We saw the general slide from the ARL. This top dark blue line here is my total materials budget, which, as you can see, continues to rise, is approaching $19 million. We thought this would be down this year. And in the end, we got a small bump, but the bump was in entailed income, gifts, endowments, special allocations. The general budget that I would just use to buy the typical STM, a publication, actually went down this year by $400,000. And that is the first time in my 20 years in Chicago that has ever gone down. The sort of a light blue line is the electronic, and as you can see, for several years of stagnating, it has now gone up dramatically in the past 2 years. I have no doubt that it will continue. This is primarily of the cancellation of the print side of journals and ebooks. The print serials, the kind of orangey line, exactly parallels with a deep decline in these past 2 years. But I also call your attention to, in my case, the print books, a kind of a purple line, which is not declining. My library is still buying print. So, moving on. I love this Gartner technology hype cycle. In retrospect, the process of converting from print to electronic on the serial side was relatively painless. Excitement, immediate acceptance on the part of my people. The articles that turned out, as we all know, were a perfect delivery mechanism for that size. And I believe that the journals immediately went to the peak of inflated expectations and stayed there. They never went through this traditional downside. Now, ebooks, for a long time, I believe, entered at the trough of disillusionment and stayed there, and were only now on the slope of enlightenment of the plateau of productivity. For some reason, they completely skipped, I believe, this peak of inflated expectations. Probably because many of them are standalone treatises that just don't lend themselves to e-delivery in the same way as a journal article does. Their usage, both in print and online, is much less than on the journal side. They have their own unique selection, a budgeting, a purchase stream that is just not as easy as the journals. And while the serials moved quite quickly to an instead of mode, ebooks until recently have been largely in addition to the print, and I believe that has only recently begun to change. I'm going to look very quickly at five types of ebooks that I'm seeing and how they operate and how they're different from me. The scholarly monograph, the books in these big aggregated collections, STM things, technical books, and some major reference books. As my example for the scholarly monographs, I chose Oxford Scholarship Online, and I need to say here that there are many examples of all of these. I just chose these as some samples. OSO was our first big ebook collection. It goes back many years already now. We certainly viewed this as not a replacement for the print. We actually saw this as really a giant index, a monograph full text index into the print content. What a radical idea. And my hypothesis was that the addition of the electronic version would increase use of the print, because if they discovered online, and then they'd say, oh, I want to go get the print. Well, what we're finding is that in the e-version, over 2,700 titles essentially, are used on an average of 17 times per year. That number will sound very small to journal publishers, but however, in the book world, that's a very good number. My print equivalents of the same books circulate on an average of once every 2 years. And that's on the high side, actually. Many of my books have been purchased decades ago and never used since. So here we see that when we have both, the online is used 34 times roughly as often as the print, but I'm seeing no increase or decline on the print side. These electronic uses seem to be new uses. People are still using the print at the same rate they always were. Aggregator titles, I chose as my example here, NetLibrary. Here we have a case, it's a big aggregation of, as you know, not a typically very, very, very highly specialized things, but general audience sorts of things. We have 6,100 of them, and they are used on an average of 8.5 times, with 79 of them used over 100 times in 2008. And as you will see as a trend, we have some bestsellers. Freakonomics, in this case, was the off-the-chart book in this collection. We also have a large number of them that aren't used at all. And indeed, 473 of them, or about 15% of them, that I also held in print, weren't used online or in print. The same trends continue. And then after that, no use, it's all over the place. Some were used in one place or the other, some in both places. There's no real trends I can find here. So here we have the online and the print that seem to be going along largely in parallel worlds, and they just both continue on their own things. STM. Springer as the example here, with apologies to the other publishers in the room. Here's a case where we have eliminated print. We have no more Springer print publications, with a couple exceptions, but primarily they're gone. And this is the first time where we did this, and indeed, like on the journal side, we canceled our print orders to fund the electronic side. Direct, a parallel here. And you can see here, the blue line is 2008, is just kind of percolating along at a relatively small level. And then right about here, the end of 08, the beginning of 09, we put MARC records for those books in our catalog. And this might say, well, that's really old-fashioned. Who uses the catalog anymore? Well, my users do. And the reason I believe they do is that, unlike the journals, which have their whole own indexing structure, they're used to going to my catalog to find books. Will that continue 20 years from now? Probably not. But for right now, we need to have a discoverability where they want it. So this transition here from a print to electronic, which happened essentially overnight, went by with zero patron complaints. I don't think many of them ever even realized it. The only problem we were having is very early on, when we didn't have those catalog records yet, we were getting patron requests for things we actually owned electronically, because they were going to the catalog, not finding it, and then doing a request. So those records really, really matter. We're also very happy with the Springer My Copy program, which Cynthia just described, not because it's heavily used, but because we knew that there would be some patrons who would continue to want the print that we wouldn't have. And so for a relatively low amount of money, if they wanted one, they could just buy their own copy. Seemed reasonable to us. I don't think the uptake has been huge, however, but if there's some uptake, right? Yeah. Okay. Technical books. The example here is Safari. Here we have a case where we have these highly detailed, heavily used technical manuals. They are always missing from the collection, pages ripped out, destroyed. They go out of out of her currency as quickly as their catalog made available. So in the online version here, we have 1,100 roughly in the collection, 23 uses per title, which is in the same area as the Hoxford thing. This is a typical number, but here we see this same kind of a compression we see over and over, that two of the books, happens to be two manuals for Perl, generate 10% of my total use. And the top 25, 50%. Absolutely parallels of what we've all seen in print on online journals. On my journals, I have roughly 5 million hits per year on the full text of my journal collections, as best as we can count. And there's about 70,000 titles in those collections. The top 250 or so are generating 50% of my use. So 70,000 titles, 50% from 250 of them, and we're seeing the same trends in the book. This is something that we should all talk about more. Reference works quickly here. On the last slide of my examples, here we have three packages. The Credo reference, which for those of you who don't know, is a reference work aggregator. Diverse publishers in one collection, Oxford Reference Online, and Gale Reference. And as you can see, Credo and ORO are getting 13.5 uses per year, on average 43 here, and Gale suddenly jumps up to 248. Again, for Gale reference, I have the titles individually cataloged in my catalog, and the other two I don't. No one goes to a reference aggregator just on the fly. They find these things through references in my catalog. Discoverability matters. One slide here, changing gears slightly, on another trend that we see is patron-initiated purchasing. It's being discussed widely amongst my colleagues, and it's being discussed with a religious fervor that's approaching that of open access. People falling into two camps. Either I'm going to build my collections the way I have always built them because I know what my patrons want, and the people who say I'm going to spend my money wisely, I'm going to buy it 3 seconds after they know they want it. And the way that this typically works with the aggregators, at least, is a library will contract with the aggregator to put the data for all of their content into their catalog, and there's a little button that says get it, and when the patron pushes the button, the library buys the book. On the surface, it's that simple, although I suspect there's a lot of paddling below the surface to make this all happen. But here we have a case where we're pre-populating our catalogs with stuff we think the patrons might want someday, and when they click on it, we have it. Not possible, at least that quickly, in the print world. Now, this assumes that long tail will be there. Here we're talking about the concept that no book will ever go out of print. And it'll be available 20 years from now when they actually want it. We'll see. Some are saying, well, some libraries are already spending half their budget this way, half of it for patron initiative. And I just recently heard someone say that within, well, perhaps provocatively, that within 5 years, 100% of their money will be spent on patron-initiated purchasing. That's got to give you all pause. What does this mean for your front list? How do you sell books up front when we're only buying them as we need them? Lots of models. We heard about the Springer model, the Espresso machine, Google Books, on and on and on. So there's many channels for here on the print on demand or the supply electronic on demand has to have an impact on the industry. One of the problems that we're facing is that, up until now at least, it's easier to buy a print book than an electronic book. Our channels are well honed. We have the approval plans. They come shelf ready with spine labels. Well, they come with cataloging. Our records are invoiced electronically. We simply pretty much open the boxes and shelve them. E-books aren't yet there. They don't intersect with the rest of my plans well. They're not announced at the same time. I have to still, in many cases, sign individual licenses for every new book as I buy it. It's not easy to do. So when we're talking about the bulk of my materials, the easy stuff, the e-book stream has to be as easy for us as the print was. What about issues like how they have to both be available at the same time, because my selector is going to be making a decision from the announcement? Well, if the e-book is announced even 6 weeks after the fact, we have the print in our collection already. We're not going to buy it twice. And there's lots of options here, including, am I going to buy the package? Am I going to buy it title by title? I think you have to provide both options, because some customers like me will typically want the large packages. Others are going to want one by one. Are we going to rent it? I've seen some rent-to-own models. After you click on it five times, you buy it, that sort of thing. A purchase on demand with the preloaded record I talked about. Bundling with the print, even if we don't buy them at the same time, this is sounding like journals again, all over again. we need to come to grips with this. The other interesting thing I'm seeing is this concept of a consortia buying an e-book package prospectively, jointly. And they all get the records, and they all load them into their own catalogs. And so in the case of the CIC, it's in all of our catalogs. And if a patron at Michigan clicks on they want it, it's suddenly owned and accessible by all the members of the group, a single copy. So we'll see where this goes. Interlibrary loan, two things here. It's a great source of the patron-initiated purchasing. We do a lot of cases where, rather than interlibrary loaning it, we just buy it. And the other interesting thing here about ILL is that we are all carefully writing into our contracts, we have the right to ILL this, but no one knows how to do it. How do you interlibrary loan something that doesn't exist physically? So we need to work out that as an industry as well and have some actual tech techniques for making that happen. Who remembers all of these? My one slide on e-book readers. We need these things to be portable, and the content needs to be universal. As a big academic library, most of my use is still on a traditional a PC screen. You know, some delivery of the content to other devices, but it's primarily here. I remember the day I got rid of my last proprietary PC-based ebook reader, and I was dancing in the streets. They're all gone. Now we see the same thing potentially happening with the Sony reader and the Kindle and on and on and on. And I don't care how many places it's delivered, also has to be on my patrons' PC screens in some native way. That's just absolutely essential. Discoverability is key. Our major goal as a consumer is usage. As I said, I delivered 5 million journal articles last year. That's 416 per patron, which is an absurdly high number, but it's apparently the case. And while the books have a much lower overall usage. It's significant, but people have to discover them. And discoverability happens in many places, and your metadata has to be in all of them. It's got to be in my catalog. It's got to be in the major indexes. It's got to be in places like Google. We've all heard about the Google effect. I've seen it. I saw some charts from JSTOR, from Springer, other places, that the metadata goes in, usage skyrockets. And it's coming from places where it didn't in the past. Libraries all have these link resolvers. At my peak, 23% of my use was through my links I was controlling. Last year, that's down to 11. Still used, but they're finding the content other places. I think, again, it's the Google bump. So my lesson here is the metadata has to be free, fluid, malleable, linkable, portable, and shareable. It's got to be every place my people are going to be, and if you try to put walls around it, it's only going to cause us, I believe, problems downstream. Return on investment. The publishers will also laugh. Oh, libraries are finally realizing that we have to provide a return. I've known this for years. Well, it's true. We're certainly seeing an increased evidence on this, but coupled with this are some real issues. We know we buy a lot of stuff over here, and we know it's used a lot over here, but it's just still these big lumps of stuff. And it's very hard. There are so many steps. How do I begin to say, oh, look, this article in JSTOR was used in 2004, and this researcher cited it in 2009. How do I put those two events together is very hard. I did some targeted research where I took one faculty member who was very prolific. I charted all his articles. I looked at all his citations. I said, do we own this content or not? I looked at the places he was cited. I said, do we own that content? My director was overwhelmed and said, this is wonderful. I want more of these. And he had to say, well, this one took me 2 weeks. We simply don't have the tools in place to do this kind of really targeted analysis. But things are happening. Paula Kaufman at Illinois has just completed her study, which is, again, big chunks. But she's saying, I bought this much stuff for this much money, and the income on my campus is getting in on grants exceeds what I'm spending on the resources. First time we've ever really even thought about, oh, how do grants interact here? Carol Tenapier, who's known to many of you, have recently received a grant to study more here, but we need to pay attention to this. So, in conclusion, eStuff is better. The serial conversion is almost complete. Ebooks are rapidly gaining acceptance. Up until about 2 years back when I would give a similar a presentation, I would have 24 slides on journals and then one slide on books that would say, I don't know. We know now. They both offer the opportunity to explore new models of purchase and access. I hope I can explore those with you. And the other trend that we're certainly seeing is that the day of monolithic library collections, just in case, is over. This is an exciting time for all of us. It's been a real pleasure to share a few of my thoughts and experiences. I hope I've raised a few questions. I will be around today, and I'll be around for the bulk of the fair. Feel free to grab me if you want to explore any more of these more. So thank you very much for your attention, and over to our next speaker.